first speaker this morning is Anton Zorich, who will tell us about the Lyapunov of exponents of the Hodge bundle and diffusion in periodic billiards.
Thanks, everybody, for coming in the middle of the night. And thanks to the organizers, I realize that this conference resembles rather ICM than a standard conference, and I realize what an effort requires an organization of such a conference. So thank you very much. I appreciate, and special thanks to Karen. I decided to present measured foliations and thermodynamics on a particular problem. So the plan of the talk is to present first, to formulate the problem and to tell the answer. Then I will tell the technology. And I apologize in advance. Plenty of colleagues know this technology much better than me, and I learned it from them. So I will be telling some elementary, extremely elementary stuff, forgive me. Then we'll arrive to some modern technology, and at the end of the talk, I hope to present the solution of the problem, not only the answer, but the solution using all this technology. And so here are first examples of measured foliations. So they are everywhere, in particular in solid-state physics. So if you consider electron transport in metals, then the particle stays on the surface of constant energy defined in the quasi-momentum space on the one hand. And on the other hand, it has to stay in the plane orthogonal to magnetic field, where in the quasi-momentum space and not in the coordinate space. So the particle really stays in the plane. And from a mathematical point of view, we have just a Z3 periodic surface in R3. We cut it, we slice it with parallel planes, we get lines, and these lines are electron trajectories. And the question, what are the trajectories? And if you quotient if you quotient your R3 by their translation by their integer lattice, you get a compact surface in a torus, in a three-dimensional torus, and a measured foliation on this surface. So this measured foliation is exactly the object we're interested in. Actually, this problem is my first problem in mathematics. It was suggested to me by Sergei Novikov in 82 when I was 20, young and ignorant. And I even managed to make some progress in this problem, proving that for open and dense set of directions of the plane, the minimal components of the corresponding foliation are just toroid with holes. So the trajectories for open and dense set of directions go along straight lines. But of course, I got stuck. And at this time, I thought I'm the only person in the world who is working with measured foliations. So I just abandoned the subject for 10 years and came back 10 years, only 10 years later. And one of the main mathematical regrets of my life is to ignore for these 10 years that actually by the end of the 70s, Bill Thurston has already created beautiful theory, which I was not aware of. So, however, I suggest another problem also suggested by physicists in the beginning of 20th century by Ehrenfest and Darrenfest, so-called wind tree model, to sort of present measured foliations. And this problem, the initial problem, is stated in terms of a billiard. So you have a billiard in a plane with periodic obstacles, aligned periodic rectangular obstacles. You send a billiard trajectory. It travels in your plane, reflects. And the question is how it propagates in the plane. So this rate of propagation is called diffusion rate. And here's an old theorem of Vincent Delacroix, Pascal Hubert, and Samuel Lelièvre. It says that the diffusion rate is the length of piece of trajectory power 2/3. So here's one definition of the diffusion rate. Another one is as follows. You just let your trajectory travel for time t. You get a curve in the plane. Take a diameter of this curve, take the log of diameter and divide by logarithm of time. So if the limit exists of this ratio, it's the diffusion rate. So as a matter of fact, if you make a random walk in the plane, you have square root of time. Here you have t to power 2/3. So your guy is not completely drunk, but slightly dizzy. A typical feature of these kind of problems is that changing the height and the width of the obstacle, we get different billiards, but it does not change the diffusion rate. So from the point of view of this theorem, these guys are also sort of generic rectangles. So we have aligned walls with very narrow holes, still the same T power 2/3. Or you can just make a chocolate plate and leave very narrow corridors, no matter, T power 2/3. Well, of course, you have seen I took logarithms. I cannot control the coefficient in front of T power 2/3. So it's sort of rough estimate, but still, it's curious that this 2/3 does not change. One can change the shape of the obstacle. For example, one can consider a wind tree like this. And for obstacles, so if you plant your wind tree with different spices of trees, you can change the rate, which here in this particular case depends only on the number of the right angles. And it tends to zero, as you can see. So double factorial means that it's the product of all even numbers, and this is the product of all odd numbers up to 2m and 2m plus 1. So this is the way to suppress the noise in the room. You can plant plenty of trees like this, which might be really tiny, but perfectly aligned. And since their diffusion rate tends to zero, you will suppress the noise. Also, the same as in the previous problem, the diffusion rate does not depend on the particular shape of the obstacle, but only on the number of corners. So you can make a carpet, a complicated carpet like this. If m is the same, it would be the same diffusion rate. Yes?
If you rescale, can you go with continuum limit?
I have to think. So now I want to abandon billiards and derive as fast as possible to surface foliations. Yeah, sure.
Number 4m and 4m minus 4, is that some theorem of geometry that it
Oh, yeah. This is sort of Euler characteristic, yeah. Yes, this is trivial. So to pass from billiards to surface foliations, let's start with the simplest billiard, a rectangular one. And this is, well, this the construction which I am telling is called Katok-Zemlikov construction, and it comes actually from mathematical Olympiads for high school students. Instead of reflecting a trajectory, one can reflect a billiard table. And the advantage is that the trajectory continues just as a straight line, you see? So this angle is the same as this angle. And we can unwrap the billiard table along trajectory, and we get a straight line from our trajectory. I suggest so the initial trajectory in the rectangle goes in, at every moment it goes in one of four directions. I suggest to assign a color to each direction and color the corresponding trajectory here. So we have four, in this particular case, at any point we have four possible patterns. Let's quotient over equivalent patterns. And I forgot to tell that if we fold this billiard table, we get original trajectories here. So it's sort of equivalent. So now instead of considering this infinite unfolding, let's quotient over equivalent patterns. And of course, we'll get a torus. We have four patterns. And our identification gives a torus. And our trajectory now becomes a winding, irrational winding line or rational winding line on a torus. And again, folding it back, we get the initial trajectory. And this is the way people study billiards and rational polygons. They unwrap a billiard to a compact surface, and trajectories are unwrapped to a measured foliation on this compact surface. So in our wind tree problem, in the initial wind tree problem, when the obstacles had rectangular shape, we can take, well, there are again four directions. So we take four copies of our billiard. We can make an additional quotient over Z2. And we get a surface which is glued from four tori with holes, and there are identifications between these holes. So we get a surface of genus 5 instead of a torus as in the previous example, and a measured foliation of this surface of genus 5. And now if we want to study the diffusion rate, one can check that what we have to do in this terminology is the following thing. Take a long piece of leaf of your measured foliation, so straight line foliation. Join the ends and count what is the intersection number of this cycle C, which depends on the length of trajectory, with the cycle H, which is represented as linear combination of these basic cycles, or cycle V. And it tells you how far you went to the right or how far you went up on the initial plane. So you can immediately recognize the initial problem in terms of this language. Just you have to sit for, I don't know, 30 seconds, observe this picture carefully, and you realize that this is exactly, absolutely equivalent. So from now on, and almost up to the end of the talk, my goal would be the following. I have a measured foliation on the surface. I want to study how their cycle obtained by a long piece of measured foliation behaves in homology. So this is the problem. Okay, to study this problem, I have to present some background, which is Tegmiller dynamics, and I sort of follow ideas of Bill Thurston. The first observation, which is absolutely elementary but very deep, is that surfaces can wrap around themselves in a complicated way. So here's the first map of a surface, the most elementary map of a surface to itself. It's a dent twist. You take a torus, you cut it along a circle, and you twist it by complete turn and then glue back. So this is one way to see this map. Another way, sort of more algebraic, is to consider an integer matrix with determinant 1. It maps an integer lattice to itself, which means that it maps a torus, which is a quotient of R2 over integer lattice, to itself. So, oops, pardon me. So this is the first way to represent our surface diffeomorphism. This is another way, using the lattices. And one more way is just observe this thing as follows. So if we take a fundamental domain of the initial lattice, which is, say, a square torus, it maps our fundamental domain to this parallelogram. And then we can take a pair of scissors, cut this triangle, and glue it here because this side is identified to this side. So by this cut and paste, we get the initial square, and we see that we map our initial torus to the initial torus. Now, concerning this map, I can, the other way to see it is as follows. Let's apply this transformation continuously, not immediately a matrix like this, but let's put here parameter t, and let's decline our parallelogram continuously. What we observe here is that we get a curve in the space of tori. If we decline just a little bit, we get completely different torus in terms of flat metric. But after time one, we get back to the initial torus, so we get a closed curve in the space of tori. Okay, so this is the most elementary example. The next one, let's compose two dent twists. One along meridian and another along parallel. Well, nothing complicated. Now the matrix, it's again can be represented as before by a linear transformation. Now the matrix is product of the corresponding matrices, and the fundamental domain is mapped to this fundamental domain, and one can repeat the construction with cut and paste. Now it would be slightly more complicated, but we can cut and paste, and we get again a square torus. And what is important, which is sort of obvious from algebraic point of view, we just have a map, an integer map, which maps a lattice to itself. What is slightly less obvious from this colored picture is that everything is extremely smooth. When we are cutting and gluing, nothing happens. It's just two different ways to unwrap our torus into a flat pattern. So when I cut and paste, I carefully, so I take care that, say, you see, this side is red, this part is red, this thing is glued to this thing is glued to this thing. So I carefully preserve the gluing rules. There's no discontinuities in my procedure. Okay. Now I arrive to pseudo-Nosov diffeomorphism. So this is automorphism of a surface. Now the measured foliation appears. Consider eigenvalues of these metrics and corresponding eigenvectors. So there are two eigenvalues. One is more than, is greater than one. One is less than one. So our linear map extends everything in direction of unstable eigenvalue of, and contracts everything in direction of contracting eigenvector. So we get a surface automorphism which preserves a pair of foliations and expands everything in one direction of one foliation and contracts everything in direction of the other foliation, or transverse foliation. And in surface automorphism like this is called the pseudo-Anosov diffeomorphism. I should say that for many years I knew Anosov and I was curious, who is pseudo-Anosov? Now I know that it's pseudo-Anosov is actually Bill Thurston. Now I know. So, and one more trivial remark is one can consider this map not as a sort of immediate map, but as a continuous deformation of the initial torus. So we have pair of foliations on the initial torus, and we can start deform the initial torus, contracting in direction of one foliation and expanding in direction of the other foliation. When we apply it a little bit, we spoil the flat metric of the initial torus, we get a completely different torus. But our observation says that after an appropriate time, T0, which is logarithm of our eigenvalue, this expansion and contraction brings us back to the initial torus. So again, once again, we get a closed curve in the space of tori, and we'll see that this closed curve actually, well, one can see that this closed curve is actually a geodesic in the space of tori. So pseudo-Anosov diffeomorphisms define closed curves and actually closed geodesics in the moduli space of Riemann surfaces. So this is a really important observation. I'm speaking about space of tori. Let me represent the space of tori. How can one parametrize tori? So there are several models which one can use to describe a flat torus. One of them is a lattice in R2. If you have a lattice in R2, I don't want to distinguish between tori, which can be obtained by a proportional rescaling. So let's rescale the torus in such a way that the shortest geodesic has length 1, so the corresponding lattice vector, the shortest lattice vector, has length 1, and also I will turn the lattice in such a way that it becomes horizontal. So this vector represents the shortest lattice vector of our lattice. Okay, this vector is turned and normalized to be placed to the standard vector. Let's take the second one. It's somewhere. But the second shortest vector of the lattice is, well, and yeah, sorry. Let's, by convention, let's take it in the upper half plane. It's our choice. Well, it is supposed to be longer than the first one, so it's supposed to be outside of this unit circle. And also, it cannot be 4, so this is definitely not the second shortest vector. It should be between two parallel lines, so we get a domain like this. It's really the fundamental domain in the space of lattices. So this is the space of tori. It's a nice surface. So one should notice that this side actually is glued to this side, this arc is glued to this arc, so we get something like this. We get a sphere with a cusp, which corresponds to tori, which are very narrow and very long. And it has two orbifoldic points which correspond to tori which have extra symmetries. And actually, this picture represents perfectly well other moduli spaces for higher genera. They are never compact because your surfaces can degenerate. You can have, well, I'm speaking about moduli spaces of flat surfaces. You can have arbitrary narrow and arbitrary long cylinders, so the space cannot be compact, and also it has some orbifoldic lossy because some flat surfaces may have extra symmetries which are not typical for all flat surfaces. So this is really a good image of what is the space of flat surfaces. To convince you that everything which I was, yeah? Yes. So I just arrived at it. Yes, of course. Of course, when you are in genus higher than one, different from one, you cannot have a perfectly flat metric, but almost. So here's an example of almost perfectly flat surface of genus 2. Let's take an octagon, a regular octagon, and let's glue all the opposite sides. So first, I want to convince you that we get a surface of genus 2 because, well, we can see it as a square from which we chopped out the corners. So when we're, if the corners wouldn't be chopped out, we would get a torus. Now, when we're starting to glue it, we first get a torus with a hole because the corners are chopped out. Then, well, I cheated a little bit. I turned the rectangular hole by 45 degrees. But when I glue this side to this side, as suggested, I get a torus with two holes like this. And now I have to identify these two holes. I get a torus with a handle, so I get a surface of genus 2. And our surface of genus 2 is endowed with a flat metric, which comes from the flat metric on this button. And the only particular thing is that it's really perfectly a flat metric except at the single point which comes from the vertices of the octagon. All these vertices are identified to one point, and at this one point, the total cone angle is the total angle which we have here, which is 6 pi. We have a conical singularity. But still, I really insist that this flat metric is wonderful and mimics the flat metric on the torus, because the flat metric on the torus, well, one of the special properties of this is that it has trivial holonomy. If you make a parallel transport of a vector along a closed curve, it comes back exactly in the same direction. Here, it's the same story, because all our identifications are just parallel transport, well, are coming from parallel transport. At no point we twisted whatsoever. So our flat metric has trivial holonomy, and if you define, if you take some direction at some point and claim this is the vertical direction, you can transport it to all the other points of the torus without any contradiction, which might come from closed trajectories. And from now on, I consider this vertical direction as a part of the structure. And by the way, another hidden structure here is complex structure, because you can consider the hyperbolic metric in the same conformal class, or you can see it differently. You can declare that your pattern lives in the complex plane, in the plane C. Since the choice of vertical direction is part of the structure, I'm not allowed anymore to turn my pattern. So the only thing which I can do is to parallel transport it in the plane Z, and I consider the coordinate Z, the complex coordinate Z on my surface, and even more, I have a holomorphic differential dz, which is well defined on the resulting surface because all the identifications are just parallel translations, z equals z plus constant. But I will sort of, mostly I will hide the structure. I will try to remain with flat surfaces, though, to be honest, this is absolutely equivalent language. One can speak in terms of spaces of flat surfaces. One can speak in terms of the moduli space of pairs, complex structure plus holomorphic one form. OK, group action. Now we arrive to a key point. So these spaces of flat surfaces are extremely rich in structures. And one of the most important ones is that there is a huge group acting on the space. And this huge group is SL2R. Just unwrap your flat surface into a polygonal pattern. So here you can see that my polygon is special. The sides are distributed into pairs of parallel sides of equal length, so it really represents a flat surface. I can identify this thing to this thing by parallel translation, this thing to this thing, and so on. I get a flat surface as in the previous slide, exactly with the same properties. And now just and also I can put it in the plane only after a parallel translation. I have vertical direction, distinguished vertical direction, which is part of my structure. Now apply any linear transformation. Well, preferably, I prefer the ones with determinant 1 because they do not change the area of the flat surface. You get a new polygonal pattern, so new flat surface with a flat metric of the same type. The fact that pairs are distributed into pairs of parallel sides of equal length is preserved, so I can glue back a surface. We have an action on the space of all flat surfaces. And part of this action is a one-parameter subgroup. We just shrink everything horizontally and expand everything vertically with the same ratio. And the key theorem on which based all the story is a theorem due to Howard Mazur and William Veitch, is that the action of the group of SSL2R and, well, this diagonal subgroup is ergodic with respect to the natural finite measure on each connected component on every space like this. So I can see the spaces of flat surfaces with fixed types of conical singularities. In the example which we considered, there was a single conical singularity with the angle 6 pi. If you go to high, well, yeah, in genus 2, you can have two possibilities, either two conical singularities with angles 4 pi or one conical singularity with angle 6 pi. When you go to higher genera, well, there are more combinations, but basically everything is described by partition of 2g minus 2 integers. It's like degrees of zeros of corresponding holomorphic 1-4. And of course, our linear transformation preserves this property, and on every connected component of a space like this, the map is, well, this action is ergodic. And now, I would like really to insist why I'm so excited about this theorem. In plain terms, this theorem says the following. Start with a randomly chosen octagon like this, well, with this property that the pairs are distributed into, well, the sides are distributed into pairs. Then, if you shrink it horizontally and pull it vertically for appropriate time, you can get arbitrary close to a regular octagon, for example. Looking at this picture, it seems contradictory. Well, you never get close to a regular octagon, right? But I'm not speaking about polygonal patterns. I'm speaking about flat surfaces. We're allowed, as we did for the torus, we're allowed to take pair of scissors and start cutting and pasting at any time we wish. And you can cut and paste, well, of course, preserving the identifications as much as you want. So the theorem says that if you choose the time in a smart way, and if you choose your cutting and pasting in a smart way, then you can get arbitrary close to any point, for example, a regular octagon. And this is much less trivial. So this is really highly non-trivial theorem.
The example you're drawing is periodic.
Huh? This surface is not yet the same.
No, but I'm saying this one is not going to be dense.
I'm saying almost. Arbitrary close to. Not exactly. So if you take the surface by random, if you, yeah, in the example with the torus, it would be exactly periodic.
Arbitrary should be almost every.
Almost.
Oh, yeah. Yes, arbitrary was at the wrong. This word arbitrary is in the wrong, at the wrong place. Yeah.
Random.
Yeah. At least it wakes up everything, everybody. Yeah. Wonderful. It worked. It was not on purpose. Okay. I presented sort of 2/3 of the necessary background. Now I want to come back to measured foliations. So remember that. The point, the object which we want to study is the following. We have a measured foliation on the surface Now I can formulate it differently. We have this flat surface and straight line foliation, and we want to study the following thing. We take a very long piece of our straight line trajectory, close it up. We get a cycle in the first homology. I want to study what is the behavior of this cycle in the first homology when the piece of trajectory becomes longer and longer and longer. Okay, let's start again with the torus and to study how can we choose when we close up the cycle. One of the ways is to choose a transverse segment, and as soon as our foliation hits the segment, we just join the endpoints of the piece of trajectory. So our foliation will hit many times this transverse interval, and we get a sequence of vectors in the homology space. And the first, well, the simple theorem says that there is a well-defined limit. If you normalize this cycle, which becomes longer and longer by number of iterations, then as n tends to infinity, we get a limit. And this is true not only for torus. There is a theorem of Steve Kirchhoff, Howie Mazur, and John Smiley, and I'm happy that two of the authors are here, that for any flat surface, directional flow in almost any direction is uniquely ergodic. So this means that in almost any direction, you have asymptotic cycle. And this asymptotic cycle is one and the same for all trajectories in this direction. Good. This is asymptotic cycle. I suggest to a procedure which allows to calculate this asymptotic cycle faster in the case when our foliation is special. Suppose that our foliation corresponds to a pseudo-Anosov map, like this foliation in direction of expanding eigenvector for this matrix. Take a closed curve and apply any closed curve, say meridian or parallel of the torus, and apply our map G, to this closed curve. So this is two sample curves, and when you apply the map G in homology of the corresponding cycles, they, of course, they are mapped to vectors which follow their expanding eigenvector, just because forget about everything. It's just elementary linear algebra. You're applying a matrix like this with one eigenvector which is clearly dominating. So all, well, basically all vectors except the one which goes in the unstable direction, they will get stretched in direction of this direction, well, in direction of the top eigenvalue. Well, the same behavior is true for these first return cycles. They get stretched along the eigenvector corresponding to top eigennumber. And the way to see it, well, it's not a proof, but it's sort of a very convincing argument. Consider this first return cycles to a segment. To see them, it's easier to consider the pattern of a torus, which corresponds to this first return map to a segment. So I take a segment, I repeat it periodically, and I see how my foliation comes back to the to this pattern. So when I apply my map, excuse me, I forgot to say, and this is important, I suggest to take this transverse segment in direction of unstable foliation. So when I apply my map once, since this cycle goes in direction of unstable foliation, it just is mapped on a sub-segment of itself, and these guys are stretched in this direction. So we get another sort of building in this, in exactly in the same lattice, but this building would be stretched, would be shrinked and stretched. And the first return cycles to this longer segment are mapped to first return cycles of the shorter segment. And we have just seen what happens to the cycles when they are mapped under this transformation. So, yeah, I forgot to say that when you start playing with measured foliations, you run into a map like this almost immediately. So I was not an exception. And fortunately for me, I was not too naive to think that I'm the first one who discovered such a wonderful map. So I started to ask, what is the name of this map? And I was lucky enough to visit a conference at MSRI in 92, and I ran into John Milner and I dared to ask, do you know by chance this map? And he said, yeah, this is called interval exchange transformation, and there is a person who knows just every bit of information about this, and this is Bill Veach. And this was, MSRI just got a brand new mathematical reviews on CD-ROM. It was just top of technology. I went to the library and I printed out the math reviews for all papers containing the word interval exchange transformation. And I'm working in this domain ever since. So I use this occasion to thank John Milner, who sort of directed me to a right spot. So this, there is nothing special for the torus. You can do exactly the same with other surfaces. You get similar story, and your first return cycles when you choose this transverse interval in direction of unstable foliation and your flow, this is direction of your, this is contracting foliation, this is expanding foliation. The first return cycles to a longer interval are mapped to first return cycles to a shorter interval, which is sort of a convincing argument that we can apply renormalization. To see the behavior of this very long first return cycles to a very tiny transverse interval, you can pretend that we're lucky and where our foliation corresponds to an Ossoff map. Well, then we have to use the matrix, the corresponding matrix in the homology induced by this Ossoff map, and everything is fine. And now, let us use the theorem of Mazur and Veach, saying that actually, this flow which contracts everything horizontally and expands everything vertically is ergodic, meaning that if we follow this flow for a long time, we can pretend we have an Ossoff map. And there is a theorem which is called multiplicative ergodic theorem, which says that this analogy is much stronger, that it says not only that you can imagine ergodic flow as a flow, a sort of repetitive flow along a very long closed curve. Moreover, the holonomy, there is sort of a virtual matrix which mimics a matrix of an Ossoff map. We'll see it in a second. And now, so to finish the story with asymptotic cycles, so if we trace for a surface of high genus, we trace these points in their 2G dimensional space representing first return cycles, well, we know that they expand in direction of asymptotic direction, but we're interested in more detail, so let's put a quadimensional one screen in our space and project everything to this quadimensional one screen. We'll see that the projections of these vectors to this screen are accumulating along a line, so all these vectors live morally around a two-dimensional plane. We know this plane. It corresponds to, it's spanned by two top eigenvectors of corresponding pseudo-Anosov map, if we have a pseudo-Anosov map, or something analogous in general situation. And then we can put a screen of codimension two, repeat the procedure, and we have, never use new devices. We get a picture where deviation in principal direction is described by some special power, in the next direction by the next power, and so on. These powers are called Lyapunov exponents, and the formal statement says that the deviation from the, that there is a flag of subspaces for, now I'm not in a pseudo-Anosov situation, I'm in almost any situation. You have flat surface and almost any flat surface, vertical foliation, horizontal foliation, you construct the sequence of first return cycles and they behave as if they mimic the situation with a pseudo-Anosov map. And these rates of deviation from asymptotic direction, they are one and the same for almost all points of each space like this. They're called Lyapunov exponents. And they correspond to the Lyapunov exponents of the Hodge bundle along the Teichmuller flow. And this will be explained in a second. I should say that I have cheated here because the fact that there are strict inequalities everywhere here is two deep theorems. The first strict inequality is proved by Giovanni Forni in 2002, and all the remaining strict inequalities are proved by Avi Laviana. So the theorem, as strong as it's presented here, incorporates these two very deep results, and they're highly non-trivial. So I have to explain what are these Lyapunov exponents, finally. First, forget about all the details which were presented. Let's consider a general setting. Suppose you have a vector bundle, a flow on the base, and suppose that this flow is ergodic, and suppose that you are lucky and you have a flat connection on the vector bundle. So you can play the following game. You take a fiber of your vector bundle and you flow it along the flow, and from time to time it comes close to the initial point, you close up trajectory, and you get a matrix of holonomy. And you continue, your matrices start to multiply, and you can ask yourself whether there is sort of some convergence in some sense, and yes, there is. There is a well-defined matrix of mean holonomy, which can be defined as this. So I multiply by a conjugate, and now I have symmetric matrix. I can take a root, and this limit exists. And the eigenvalues, or rather logarithms of eigenvalues, are called Lyapunov exponents. So Lyapunov exponents, they mimic eigenvalues of a pseudo-Nosov diffeomorphism. You pretend that your flow is periodic, and you have just one pseudo-Nosov diffeomorphism along a very long trajectory. Eigenvalues, these are the guys. Now, what is the manifold and what is the vector bundle in our case? The manifold is our space of flat surfaces. The flow I already presented is the flow which is contracting everything and expanding everything. And the vector bundle is the Hodge bundle. It associates, so we're working with space of surfaces. We can consider their homology or cohomology, rather, in this case, of our surface, and we get a vector bundle. And we have a natural flat connection of this vector bundle because since it's not an abstract vector space, it's cohomology, we have integer lattice in cohomology. And there is the only way to deform our vector space in such a way that the lattice follows the lattice. And this is the flat connection, which is called Gauss-Meinl connection. Now, one more remark. The holonomy matrices here come from diffeomorphisms of the surface. So they preserve intersection form. They correspond to symplectic matrices. They have extra symmetry of eigenvalues, and that's why the spectrum of Lyapunov exponents is symmetric with respect to change of the sign. Remember, my Lyapunov exponents are logarithms of eigenvalues, not eigenvalues themselves. Okay. Now, in the way I presented this story, one can get an impression that so the only persons who sort of gave some impact on the story is Lyapunov, Hodge, well, famous German mathematician collaborators Gauss and Manin, Thurston, Mazur, and Beach, and myself. Well, this is not quite correct, and actually this is dramatically wrong. The whole story is based on it's really, in the sense of sequence of good luck, coincidences, and incredibly strong results, which are obtained in the last 20 years in adjacent areas. So the relation of the Lyapunov exponents to the deviation spectrum and the first idea how to compute the Lyapunov exponents, it's our games with Kantsevich in the, well, the mid-90s. As I already mentioned, the inequalities for Lyapunov exponents, that's two deep theorems of Giovanni Forni and of Arturo Avila and Marcello Viana. Now, to apply ergodic theorem, you have to know ergodic components. So you have to know components of this, connected components of these spaces of flat surfaces, and this is the classification, it's our work with Kantsevich. Now, volumes are computed by Eskin and Okunkov, and this is a highly non-trivial computation. So volumes of these spaces, and they are needed to get numbers. So you don't want to have just qualitative theory. You want to have these two-thirds at the end of the day. And to get these two-thirds, you have to know volumes. Also, there is a whole marvelous story of counting closed geodesics on individual flat surfaces, and this is developed by Veitch and by Mazur and Askin. And one of the key ingredients is the Ziegel-Veitch constant, which is responsible. It's a coefficient in the exact quadratic asymptotics for the number of closed geodesics on individual flat surface. And this is developed so by these people. Also, to get two-thirds, you have to ask Kurt to classify all SL2R invariant manifolds in genus 2. And I'm not mentioning plenty of wonderful results around. I'm mentioning only those which are ingredients in this wind tree problem mentioned at the beginning. So there are plenty of things. Well, there are results of John Smiley and Barak Weiss on unipotent flow. There are results of Martin Mueller and Arend Boe on Lyapunov exponents of cyclic curves. There are plenty of marvelous results here. I'm a lucky man. So, state of the art. We arrived to state of the art and to the solution of their wintry problem. First, Lyapunov exponents, it's a great thing, but usually you cannot compute them. It's something completely transcendental. Here, in this particular case, we are so lucky and there are so many structure, beautiful structures, that it is possible to compute, well, not the individual ones, but the sum of Lyapunov exponents, and here's the formula. It is expressed in terms of these cone angles plus this mysterious C area. This is the Ziegel-Veitch constant, which comes from this theory of counting closed geodesics on individual flat surfaces. And I cannot explain what is this, but I can give a formula for this, at least, which gives a sense of what is going on here. It's some expression, some polynomial expression in terms of volumes of strata of flat surfaces which correspond to possible degenerations of flat surface normalized by the volume of the initial stratum. Well, with some weights which is explicit combinatorial factor, rational number here. It should be completed, but it's doable. So it's something which can be, so this means, this formula shows that if you know the volumes, you can compute this explicit combinatorial factor, you can compute the sums of Lyapunov exponents. Now, by the way, how one can, yeah?
Some of the ingredients that you mentioned suggest that it might be possible to get other symmetric polynomials from the previous ones. Is that something you can track?
The ingredients which I show suggest that one can get other symmetric polynomials in Lyapunov exponents. Probably. I forward your question to Simon Philippe, that he has an idea about this. And, well, he is next door. But it's highly non-trivial. Because if you play just elementary linear algebra and you consider, say, from the initial bundle wedge products and so on, you have just sums of Lyapunov exponents.
Does it also believe that the individual exponents are transcendental in some cases?
I'm afraid that yes, but since recently I have a hope that one can not compute them but estimate them.
Yes.
Say, found some bounds. Yes, so that's why we are not, so Simon Philippe tried to convince me that something like this, well, some other functions in Lyapunov exponents are probably computable. If it's true, that would be wonderful. I do not quite understand his arguments. So how one computes the volumes, by the way? One of the way to compute the volume is to compute integer points in the huge ball. And integer points in this particular case are flat surfaces tiled with squares. And in a particular case, when our surface, yeah, and I forgot to say that up to now I considered flat surfaces which are obtained by just from a polygon by parallel translations of the opposite, of the corresponding sides. One can consider slightly more general metrics where the holonomy is not completely trivial, but where you are allowed making a parallel transport of your vector, flip it to the opposite direction. So it's slightly more general situation, and it also corresponds this time not to holomorphic one-forms, but to quadratic differentials. So in particular, one can consider meromorphic quadratic differentials with at most simple poles on CP1, and starting from now, this is what I'm interested in for a while, for 5 minutes. And well, to compute volumes, you have to compute how many surfaces with prescribed cone angles of genus and surfaces of genus, how many spheres with prescribed, flat spheres with prescribed cone angles, tiled with square, with at most, I don't know, 1 zillion squares you can find. And well, spheres like this are branched covers of a standard sphere, so actually the equation of computation of volumes is equivalent to equation of computation of corresponding Hurwitz numbers. So this is the flat spheres which you are constructing. You are given 1 zillion partons like this, and well, the question is how many connected creatures can you, with prescribed cone angles, you can construct. Thanks, Gabi, for the photo. Okay, so there is a theorem, and the whole theory is for this slightly more general flat surface absolutely parallel. Everything works. You have to correct slightly the formula for the Lyapunov exponents. You see, this rational function is slightly different. The trouble is that for quadratic differentials, well, there is an analogous formula for the Ziegler-Witch constant, but there is no formula for volumes. Well, there is formula for volumes. There is a work of Eskin, Okunkov, and Panduripanda, but unfortunately, the formula, well, it's rather an algorithm, and at the current stage, the algorithm is sort of inefficient. We don't have values. This algorithm doesn't give numbers. One can bypass this trouble in one particular case in the following way. Consider this formula in the case when g is equal to 0, as in the previous slide, when we have a sphere. Sphere does not have first homology. So on the left, g is equal to 0, and on the left, we have 0. So we get an immediate expression of this Ziegler-Witch constant in terms of this thing. This is the expression. On the other hand, and this expression and the fact that this that we have also expression in terms of volumes allows to compute the volumes. So let's define a function like this. So again, double factorial is product of all even numbers of all odd numbers. So just elementary function of simple function of an integer number n. And here's the formula for the volumes in genus 0. Just the product of all of these functions with respect to all the centers which encode the conical singularities. This formula was conjectured by Maxim Kontsevich about 10 years ago, and using approximate values of Lyapunov exponents which were obtained by computer, he first guessed formula for the volumes of this thing using this Ziegler-Witch constant, and then made ambitious guess for general case, and yeah, we proved it. So the proof is that on the one hand, we have this expression for Ziegler-Witch constant, and on the other hand, we have expression in terms of the volumes. So you guess the answer, and you verify that this answer fits this plenty of relations. And for a long time, we considered this as a sort of a, well, the formula for Lyapunov exponent was not proved and so on. We tried to prove it honestly. We knew the answer. No way. We tried at least 6 different combinatorial approaches. No way. The only proof which I know is this word proof through Lyapunov exponents, which were not designed to compute volumes. Everything was designed to do vice versa. And by the way, even proving these relations, it's not completely trivial. You have to prove some relations between multinomial coefficients. Unfortunately, you can write here generating functions and use some functional relations on these generating functions to prove this combinatorial relation. So these guys are multinomial coefficients, so multinomial coefficient like this. And this is just one multinomial coefficient which is spoiled by this factor. And here, the sum of all complementary multinomial coefficients, which complementary because if you sum this thing, you get this guy. And this guy, you get him. Okay, so this is just to show off and to show that Lyapunov exponents can be useful for computing volumes. And we have just seen that volumes is the same thing as computing some Hurwitz numbers. Now, I promised the state of the art, and here's the state of the art. So we arrived at a fantastic theorem, which is just proved by Alex Eskin and Maria Mirzahani. They prove that the closure of any SL2R orbit is suborbifold, and that in special coordinates on the space of flat surfaces, it's just an affine subspace. And even not just arbitrary affine subspace, but some very particular one. There are plenty of constraints. I do not want to go into details, but it's quite limited. And also, the invariant measures are the natural invariant measures corresponding to these affine subspaces. Now, a development of this story is effective methods of constructing these orbit closures. Again, I'm not stating the exact result, but they are a collection of theorems due to Alex Wright and Alex Wright and collaborators and just other people. So it's a story in plain development which really allows you to, I give you a flat surface, you push the button, you find the orbit closure. Well, this is a dream, but in many cases, this works already. One more theorem. For it's sort of non-commutative analog of Kirchhoff-Mazur-Smiley theorem. For any given flat surface, I insist for any given flat surface, and in almost all directions are Lyapunov generic. So if you know the orbit closure of this particular flat surface, then you know Lyapunov exponents and all this story about asymptotic flank in almost all directions. And now we arrive to a solution of the wind tree problem. So first, you notice that any wind tree flat surface is a cover of a surface in the hyperelliptic locus in genus 1, and that the cycles H and V we are interested in are induced from this surface. So we reduced the problem actually to genus 1. Then you prove that your orbit closure is this hyperelliptic locus, and hyperelliptic locus is related to genus 0. For genus 0, we know the volumes and we know Zygizdevich constant. We can recalculate the Zygizdevich constant for genus, for corresponding hyperelliptic locus in genus 1. And since in genus 1 there is a single Lyapunov exponent, we can compute it. So this is two-thirds or this rational number which was shown in the initial slide. And also now I can explain the joke with the old theorem. So in a sense, up to this theorem of Eskin and Mirzahani, every occasion when you managed to find these two-thirds or something which works was sort of a lucky coincidence. And starting from this theorem, it's a point of sort of hard working and technology. Morally, this theorem says you want to know everything about this particular flat surface, work hard, find the orbit closure of this particular flat surface, work hard, get estimates or answers for Lyapunov exponents, you have the answer. Okay, what's next? I have another 1 minute, I guess, right? First, I would like to suggest a collection of open problems. So some problems are solved. There are plenty of new problems. Very challenging question is, well, now we know that orbit closures are extremely nice. Classify them. Nobody knows whether classification is like classification of simple Lie algebras or simple finite groups. It might be nice or complicated. Nobody knows, but there are indications that it's highly non-trivial because there is a new invariant orbit closure, well, new invariant submanifold, which is just found by Maria Mirzahani and Alex Wright of completely mysterious origin. We do not understand where it comes from. Well, maybe they, maybe meanwhile they already understand. Estimate individual Lyapunov exponents. And for this, one has to relate the individual Lyapunov exponents and this sub-bundle, these terrible sub-bundles, measurable sub-bundles of Lyapunov subspaces to holomorphic sub-bundles of the Hodge bundle. Prove conjectural formula for asymptotics of volumes. When genus goes to infinity, there it lists conjecturally, and in the simplest case, this conjecture is already seemed to be confirmed by very recent work of Dawei Chan, Martin Mueller, and Don Zagier, that the formula for the volume of all these spaces simplifies enormously, and sort of in the limit to resemble something which was presented in genus zero. Very simple formula. It allows to compute Ziegler-Witch constant, Lyapunov exponents, so, but it should be completed. Also, one has to find values of volumes of quadratic differentials. A very challenging problem is relate everything to algebraic geometry, not do it analytically, but to express the area in terms of intersection, construct and interpret, well, find interpretation in terms of intersection theory, saying the spirit of Euler's phi formula for Hurwitz numbers. And another problem, forget about Riemann surfaces. Why not consider families of other complex varieties and play the same game? We have Hodge bundle and so on. And even more interesting is to go backwards. Okay, we have families of, say, some results are already obtained, well, experimental results for some particular families of Calabi-Yaus, but are there sort of equivalent of billiards which are beyond this? This would be nice to find them. And to finish, I want to present a group photo made at the last Oberwolfach conference in March 14. As you see, most of participants were extremely young. So I think that the average age of the of participants was, I don't know, 35. Extremely bright young people, wonderful results, just breathkeeping. And to my mind, well, some of these young people probably do not realize to what extent what they are doing is relies on the results of Bill and of what he did. But well, they're continuing, they are bright. So you have young guys, plenty of nice problems. I'm sure that you will create plenty of beautiful mathematics. So you are next. Thank you.